Friend, please tell me what I can do about this world I hold to and keep spinning out. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day the cloth was well woven, so I bought some burlap, but I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longing and now I discover I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage and now I notice that I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed and now I'm proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds on to one thing. So, no matter what we do, as you know, the mind, the ego, has a very subtle and not so subtle way of coming around the back door and appropriating whatever it is that we do, however spiritual we think we are or become. So you might notice, you know, when you're meditating, you know, you're having a quiet sit and you feel peaceful and concentrated and very present and things are going well, and then the voice comes up, oh, doing pretty good. I think I've got this down. Yeah, maybe I'll start teaching this soon. Yeah, I can see myself being this big meditation person. Yeah. And then suddenly we just run away and the mind's going for a spin, going for a drive. So notice that. Notice how the so one way of understanding a doorway into this reflection or inquiry is as one of my teachers in India used to say, the self is just an I thought that claims experience. You know? So you're sitting there quietly breathing, being aware of your breath, and then the I thought pops up. Oh, now I'm breathing. Now I'm aware of my breath. Now I'm doing this. Now I'm doing this. This is the way that the mind we have an experience in the moment and then it goes back to the past to claim it. I did that. Notice when you're sitting, if you're having any experience, a really positive experience, and the mind almost simultaneously is planning how you're going to tell somebody what happened. You know, you're rehearsing, you know, you have this great thing, you saw this great swan swimming on the pond, or, you know, and you're barely noticing it by you telling you when you get home, oh, I can't wait to tell so-and-so that what I saw, you know, what I saw. So when you notice all the stories come back to the main actor, who's the main actor in our stories? It's not Brad Pitt. Me, or it's you, or I. So it's good to have a sense of humor about all of this. Not to beat up on ourselves, you know, there's the self, you know, we shouldn't be doing that. No, it arises. Like everything else, the right comes and goes, and that's what we do with it. And do we buy into that? Oh, now I'm a really great meditator, you know, look at me. See how the ego sort of boosts itself up with anything. And if we can just, you know, have some space with that and some humor. Because we'll just as easily deflate ourselves. How we're not doing something well enough. Not good enough. So the two sides of the same coin, inflation, deflation, we go through that. Moment by moment, day by day. No stable ground for that sense of self. That's why it always feels tenuous and unreliable. So going back to that list that mentioned that the Buddha taught about the skandhas, the five skandhas. So we have the identification with the body, we have identification with our feelings, with our emotions as who we are. Sometimes that's a stronger place of identification. I'm a sad person, I'm a happy person, I'm a depressed person, or I'm a selfish person, I'm a good person. Whatever the identity is, whatever the habit energy, whatever the habit tendency of our emotional life, we tend to think that that's who we are. And it's just a tendency of heart and mind that's happening. There's a license, there's a number plate on a car down the road from me, and down the road from where I teach. And the number, and in California, you can personalize your number plate. You know, so it's all about you, of course. You know, in fact, I saw a bumper sticker on the car. It's all about me. And I thought, no, it's all about me. You've got to run. Anyhow, so there's a number plate that says number one loser. And I thought, God, that's a sad identity to take birth in. You actually stick it on your car. Number one loser. Anyhow, so, you know, it's to be curious about where you take your, what identity you've taken to be true about who you are and how you believe it, and how you tell stories and how you create situations to reenact or reaffirm that. You know, so if you feel like you're a failure, you'll probably keep creating the circumstances where that keeps manifesting. We affirm our identity. The identity is one of the things that we most like to preserve, even if it's a negative one. The for whatever reason, the egoic structure really likes to hold tight to its identity. So if for some reason we've developed a negative identity from childhood or conditioning or life experience, no good at things, or I'm always last, or I'm always never fit in, or I'm, you know, we'll keep creating circumstances to affirm that identity, and we'll actually reject, we'll push things away that go against that reality, even if it's a positive thing, because we don't want it threatening our identity. So I had someone on my last retreat who always felt like an outsider, always felt, you know, like a loner, excluded by groups, and we had this retreat. It was a very lovely retreat. It was a small group. It was 12 people, and it was very friendly and warm, and, you know, very inclusive and inviting. And it was really challenging for him because it was challenging his identity, because he really wasn't an outsider. He was really quite well loved in that group. Really, people really liked him, but it challenged the identity of I'm always an outsider. I'm never included. So we all have a variation on that theme. This is a cartoon that I like. It's called Rhymes with Orange. It's a lovely cartoon skit on being human. This cartoon strip's called Checklist of Feeling Pathetic. Mm-hmm. See if you notice any of these things that we do to ourselves. So first caption: choose somebody and compare yourself unfavorably to them. Caption 2: examine your face closely in the mirror and notice all the flaws. This is a popular meditation one. Relive embarrassing, awful moments that occurred years ago. You kind of rehashing these old, horrible, embarrassing scenarios. Make a mental list of all the people you regularly disappoint. Yeah, we laugh, right? That's funny. Disregard all compliments, especially from people who supposedly love you. Picture a person and someone saying, "Oh, you look great," and they're saying, "Don't patronize me." And lastly, resign yourself to believing that from now on this is how you will always feel. Checklist of feeling crappy about ourselves or about life. And so we could probably each create our own cartoon, right, of the things that, you know, we do that we identify with that make us feel miserable. So, and sometimes as we become more present, more mindful, we start to see, God, there's actually a lot more than I even realized. We just hadn't noticed them because we weren't that present. And then as we get more present, it's like, wow, a lot of things I do that really don't really make me happy. So, and one of those is our inner critic, the judge, the inner judge, the voices that, you know, we create a lot of identity around this, the inner critic that's always on our case about doing something, or that we haven't done something, or we're not enough in some way, we're deficient in some way. Anybody notice they have a little critic? I think it's the most common malaise that I see working with anybody. I work with a lot of people, teaching, therapy, coaching, and in all realms I see it. That we buy into this inner voice that is telling us, no, that was useless. Well, that was a waste of time. That was stupid. Well, yeah, you're pretty down. I believe you said that. Why do you bother? You may as well just give up. And he comes into, follows us into the meditation room. God, how many breaths have you followed today? 3? 1 o'clock? It's pathetic. You know, it's just... And for some reason, we listen to it. That's the weirdest thing. Like, if I often ask people, imagine your best friend was just following, you know, 1-2 steps behind you and was just taking the voice of the critic. Well, that's pathetic. I can't believe you said that. Oh, you're so stupid. Oh, you're so dumb. I can't even... We wouldn't stand it for, like, 10 seconds. You know, we'd say, excuse me, thank you very much. You know. Then, no thank you, that's not true. Stop bugging me. Whatever, you know, we wouldn't just say, oh, yes, William, that's good. But we do it to ourselves. You know, and it's a tremendous form of suffering. And so, it's really important with mindfulness to turn to that voice, to recognize when judging, when that negative self-judging is happening. And there's a difference between a judgment and a discernment. A discernment, you know, you could finish your day of work and realize that you didn't really get much done that day. For whatever reason, lots of distractions, you were tired, you know, just, you know, sometimes we just don't get much done. And we can just make that evaluation, oh, didn't get much done today. Or when it comes to the voice of the judge is, what a pathetic, useless waste of time. I mean, what a waste of a day. I can't believe you blew all that. You know, very different quality, same data, same, you know, work day. So to really notice when that voice is playing out, it's recognize, name, oh, judging. Yeah. Notice how that creates a sense of self that feels deficient, unworthy, shame, less, small, hopeless, useless, defeated, right? I'm getting depressed just talking about it. Right? And it's just a bunch of thoughts that we've listened to for so long, it's become reality. If you wrote down 20 of your top favorite judgments, self-judgments, not favorite, but popular, and shared them with somebody, they go, that's not true. You know, that's not my experience of you. But we somehow believe it. We give it a lot of authority. So noticing that identity as you meditate, you know, as you take birth in that, you know, as it creeps into this practice, as it creeps into everything that you do, can creep in. You know, you can just say thank you very much, very interesting, have a nice day, they say in America, goodbye, you know. Yes. Well, that's not true, go away, enough, you know. You know, ideally we learn to ignore it, it's like a little yapping dog that just, don't need to give it much attention. So there's the emotions, and this is reflecting on how you identify with certain strong emotions and feelings as who you might be, characterizing who you are. And then the third category is perceptions, the subtle. So these go from the gross to the subtle perceptions, the way we see things, the way we see the world. We tend to identify with how we see the world how it is. Right? My view, my perspective, my perception is how it is. As do the other 6 billion people in the world think this is my perception, my view is how it is, right? And they're often quite different. You know, you go see a film, you know, with some friends, one person loves it, one person hated it, one person thought it was boring, one person thought it was stimulating. Same film, different perception. Whose perception's right? Every perception is subjective. We sometimes have a lot of shared, agreed upon perceptions of things. Warm sun is generally a good thing, and etc. But to see the relativity of our perception and to see the subjectivity and often not so inaccurate nature of our perception. The Buddha said, that which we conceive is ever other than is so. That we conceive of, perceive, and can conceptualize about is often very different than what is so. So there's a There's a line from a Korean Zen teacher called Chinmu, who wrote this lovely book called Tracing Back the Radiance, which is a great title for a book. I should have thought of it myself. And he has this book, he has a line, he says, don't side with yourself. Don't side with your, you know, speaking to this teaching, you know, that, you know, you ever notice when you're having an argument with somebody, you know, some partner or boss or whatever, whose side are you on? It's not saying ignore yourself or reject yourself, but just to see how we take our own position and how we take that position to be the ultimate truth. So this is part of a poem that I like. Is about perception. It's about the painter Monet, and this poet's taking the view of Monet, of being Monet, and being told there's something wrong with his eyesight because of his funny paintings. Doctor, you say that there are no halos around the streetlights in Paris, and what I see is an aberration caused by old age and affliction. I tell you, it has taken all my life to arrive at the vision of gas lamps as angels, to soften and blur and finally banish the edges you regret I don't see, to learn that the line I call the horizon does not exist, and sky and water so long a part of the same state of being. 54 years before I could see ruined cathedral is built of parallel shafts of sun, and now you want to restore my youthful errors, fixed notions of top and bottom, the illusion of three-dimensional space, wisteria separate from the bridge it covers. What can I say to convince you the Houses of Parliament dissolve night after night to become the fluid dream of the Thames? Beautiful line. I will not return to a universe of objects that don't know each other, as if islands were not the last children of one great continent. The world is flux, and light becomes what it touches, becomes water, lilies on water. A beautiful poem. You know, Monet is seeing something. It's just seeing the, you know, light and fluidity of light, and that things aren't as discrete and as separate and as concrete and as fixed as we, as the mind likes to think they are. But there's a fluidity, and his paintings speak to that. That perception. We have a different perception of light and the world. So this perception, then the fourth area that we take us, that we, where we construct the sense of self, is with our thoughts. Our thoughts, as the Buddha said, with our thoughts we make the world. With our thoughts we create the world. Mind is the forerunner of all things. With our thoughts we create the world. With our concepts we make the world. With our ideas, we construct the world, of meaning, of view, of separation, of ideas, of this and that. So there's a great teaching in the teachings from the Buddha, where he's teaching this young man called Bahia, who wanted to know the essence of the Buddha's teaching, and maybe he'd heard that the Buddha could be a little verbose. So he said, just please give me like the kernel of the kernel, like, you know, no time for long teaching, just give me the, you know, kind of like how we want it, like just tell me how it is, like just give me the, you know, the cliff notes. So just email me it, you know, in two lines. So I'll give part of the teaching. So his response to it here was, this is a reflection, you know, reflect on later. In the seeing, there is just the seeing. In the hearing, there is just the hearing. In the sensing, there is just the sensing. In the cognized, in the thought, there is just the cognized. This is the end of suffering. In the seeing, there's just seeing. In the hearing, there's just hearing. In the sensing, there's just sensing. In the cognized, there's cognized. This is the end of suffering. When you realize there's no separation between here and there, between the perception and the arising of whatever's appearing, when you see through that separation, this idea of this separate identity of me and the rest of the world, we see the end of suffering in that moment. So what we normally do with experience is we see something, and then we have a concept, you know, an idea about it, and a story, and the whole world takes place with every perception we have some thing play out. So let me give an example. I can't think of one that captures it, but you know, I mean, just think about all the people that are here in this room today. How many thoughts have you had about the different people here? How many ideas about who this person is, or what kind of work they do, or whether you would like them or not, or whether you'd like to be friends or not, or whether you'd like to be lovers or not, or who knows what story you've made up about probably quite a few people in the room, right? Probably never met them, may never see them ever again. But the mind's very comfortable at you know, making up a whole story about, oh, I bet they're a journalist and that person's a lawyer and that must be really difficult in a conflict. And, you know, this whole little movie going on about the people, you know, and we have no idea. You know, I do teach a lot of silent retreats, and on silent retreats you get a much longer time to sort of spin out about people because you don't talk to them, but you're around them all week. You know, and you see them at breakfast and they look kind of grouchy and you think, oh, they're definitely, you know, some kind of difficult person. And, you know, and okay, this whole, and then we do this with everything all the time. You walk through the park and we put in stories and ideas, and you know, that person looks really Russian, and that person's, you know, who knows, you know. And then we believe the perception, we believe the story that we're creating. And we do the same with ourselves. We create these stories about ourselves, stories about the world and people and nationalities, strong one. Racism comes out of that perception and the assumption, the projection. So to notice the story making nature of the mind, we like to tell ourselves stories about ourselves and the world. So this is from a teacher, Byron Katie. People know the teacher Byron Katie? She known over here? A little bit, a few people know her name. So she's a teacher. She lives out in Southern California, and she's a really good teacher. So this is, she's giving a commentary on Tao Te Ching, and she says, mind gives birth to infinite worlds of this and that, loss and sorrow, good and evil. It's complete from the beginning and yet inexhaustible in the production of what isn't. Believing what you think, you're carried off into the endless dramas of the self. Until there's peace within you, there is no peace in the world. When you're in dreamless sleep at night, is there a world? Not until you wake up and say, I. When the I arises, welcome to the movie of who you think you are. But if you question it, there's no attachment. It's just a great movie. Get the popcorn, here it comes. She's an American, they make popcorn movies. You know. I live in completeness. All of us do, though we may not realize it. I don't know anything. I don't have to figure anything out. I gave up 43 years of thinking that went nowhere. Now I exist as a don't-know mind. That doesn't mean a stupid mind. It means a mind that doesn't buy into the story-making of the mind. That's just curious. What is this? And that's the main question in Korean Zen. What is this? That's the meditation. What is this? You know, anything comes up in experience, what is this? What is this? What is this body? What is this mind? What is it? Who are you? What is this? And we get curious, stay curious. What is this? Who knows what it is? So the Buddha called all this story making about ourselves Sakyadiri, self-view. It's one of the fetters that bind us. So to get to know the personality view that you create about yourself in your thoughts. So when you're meditating, notice the stories that are being told about yourself. See whether they're true. So I was teaching a retreat in Bodh Gaya some years ago in India, and we were having these meetings, group discussion, and this young man reporting his experience, and he said, you know, I had an interesting day yesterday. You know, my meditation was going really well, and I was concentrated and mindful and a lot of joy and really focused, and I was loving the sitting and meditation, the walking meditation, and you know, I started thinking about how great it would be to do this on a longer retreat and maybe go to Burma and study as a monk and maybe live in a cave and have years to really just dive into this sort of joyous, peaceful, clear, you know, and get enlightened and, you know. And then, of course, he got so excited and agitated about this really cool idea of going to Burma and becoming a monk, and he started thinking much more than he was meditating and focusing. By the end of the day, he was very haggard and ragged and restless and busy and distracted, and he wanted to leave the retreat. He'd gone from wanting to ordain as a monk in Burma to wanting to leave the retreat. So, the story-making nature of the mind. It's like these thought trains that arise, and we jump on them. So, a friend of mine we were doing this retreat together in Insight Meditation Society in Barrie on the East Coast, and it was a long retreat. And there was this one man who was particularly noisy, like really, really loud. Just whatever he did was loud. So he was sort of... anyhow, so my friend's walking, doing some quiet walking meditation in the basement. It's very quiet and then late at night and just minding his own business. And then this guy walks down with all his noisy clothes and some slamming doors and running down the stairs and walks past my friend and as a like, tornado walks past. And the thought my friend had was, well, at least I've got less self than him. So be watchful of the mind. It's got no pride. So, it's actually just a story from the Jewish tradition that kind of echoes that. So one day a rabbi, in a frenzy of religious passion, rushed in before the ark, fell to his knees, and started beating his breast, crying, "I'm nobody! I'm nobody!" The cantor of the synagogue, impressed by the example of spiritual humility, joined the rabbi on his knees, calling out, "I'm nobody! I'm nobody!" The Shamus, the custodian, watching from the corner, couldn't restrain himself either. He joined the other two on his knees, calling out, "I'm nobody! I'm nobody!" At which point, the rabbi, nudging the cantor with his elbow, pointed at the custodian and said, "Look who thinks he's nobody." So, yes, so the mind. The comparing mind. So, and it's not necessarily about being nobody. This teaching, that's one of the confusing things about this teaching is that people think, well, and here, the way it's received is, oh, well, there's no self, then I don't exist, and I must be nobody. And it's like, no, that's not what it's pointing to. It's pointing to see, it's really about seeing the self construct. It's a construct. If you think about your self image or your self identity in your mind, it's a construction that's developed over decades. And that's what's being seen through as the illusion, right? The body clearly exists. The emotions are real. To be respected and appreciated and all of that. But the construct that we create, that's what's being seen through as the fabrication of mind. Okay? So the last of these five categories are body, feelings, perceptions, mental processes, and then consciousness, awareness. More subtle, to understand what the nature of awareness is. Awareness is that which allows us to know. You hear the sound of the bell. Sound arises and is known. Right? You don't have to go, okay, now I'm going to hear. Okay. No, you just hear, it just happens. That's awareness. Awareness allows sense experience to be known. But it begs the question, what is this awareness? And do we take that as who we are? sort of like the last bastion of self-identity. If I'm not my thoughts, I must be the person aware of the thoughts. And we can see how that process is also selfless. It happens by itself. You hear the sound. Sound arises. Buddhist psychology, the sound arises, hearing consciousness arise. They rise simultaneously. And this cognition, sound, bell, all happens organically, naturally, spontaneously. There's no one behind it going, oh, that's a bell. Well, we might feel like that's what's happening, but it's all just arising naturally. Okay, so enough words from me.